There must be 50 ways to support your station. One you might not have considered is donating your car to KZFR 90.1 FM. It's easy, and your unwanted car, boat, or truck will help provide quality programming for KZFR. So if making a pledge is not your thing, but you have an old car you no longer need, call 888-593-7288 to schedule a convenient time to pick it up. Or go to www.kzfr.org to donate online.
All right. Okay. Hi. Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by OM Foods, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. OM Foods serves homemade teas and lemonade, acai bowls, and smoothies blended with coconut water. And you can find them at 142 Broadway, just two blocks from Chico State. They're open Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and on Saturday from 11 to 3 with to-go and catering available. For more info, you can find them at iloveomfoods.com and on Facebook. And we're made possible by Peterson Tree Care because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio.
Show, we'll be covering good news on New York's declawing ban, an unexpectedly compassionate change at the Sonoma County Fair, a market update on vegan alternative meat in the fast food industry, and we'll end with a nationwide change in dreadful mouse and rat experimentation policy. Ready? Here is the plugging in the table.
Thanks, Danny. On today's, I am happy to say that cats in New York are free to scale couches, window screens, and curtains with their claws unclear. Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a bill this week that bans cat decline, making New York the first state to outlaw the practice. The bill, passed by the State Assembly in June, will take effect immediately, according to the governor's office. Removing a cat's claw gods, of course, requires a partial amputation of the last bone in each of the toes on the cat's front feet. The governor's office said that cats often strain their leg joints and spine in response to the removal, which can result in chronic pain. In the statement, Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris compared the procedure to severing a human being from the neck. The text of this brand new bill reads in part, cat's claws play an important role in various aspects of their lives. When a person has their animal declawed, usually when they attempt to protect furniture, they do fundamental damage to the animal both physically and behavioral ways. The bill makes exceptions for therapeutic purposes, in air quotes, or when the decline is benefit the cat's health, say, between the two words. Veterinarians are split on whether this cat declawing is humane. The American Association of Feline Practitioners said it strongly opposes declawing as an elective procedure.
We've got one planet.
Scratching
one
is chance. A normal feline behavior, the group wrote in a statement, as cats scratch to maintain the motion they need to climb and to keep their claws sharp. Plus, I'll say, they enjoy scratching the heck out of everything, right? That's
I hear the intro music is still playing somewhere.
All
thank
right.
Our,
I turn that off. We shall
dedicated
see.
Dedicated listeners for pointing that out.
All right, here we are back online. Thank you so much for your patience. The New York State Veterinary Medical Society said it supports declawing as an alternative to euthanasia for cat owners with impaired immune systems or diabetes. The group believes that as a veterinarian, they should be permitted to make medical decisions after direct consultation with a client and a thorough examination of the patient and its home circumstances. Lawmakers in Massachusetts proposed a state ban on feline declawing earlier this year. That bill is set for a public hearing this week. The bill text also mentions that declawing is illegal in several countries, including the UK, Israel, and Switzerland. Under the new law, anyone, specifically veterinarians, who performs a declawing procedure would face a fine of up to $1,000. And that is good news out of New York State. The California bill, declawing bill, died in committee in April of this year. One of its main opposing entities was the California Veterinary Medical Association, and I think that is just a shame. And I just think that bills like these are important because they empower the inner goodwill of a veterinarian to work on behalf of what I think are their true clients, right? The veterinarian is in this awkward position. The individual paying the bill is the owner, but the individual benefiting from their service is the companion animal. And so I think this allows the compassion in a veterinarian to shine and lets them oppose the will of the human owner on behalf of the cat.
It's got to be stressful to be in that position as a veterinarian. Hopefully this New York bill will serve as some precedent and California can try again.
I'm sure it will. The declawing bill in California has been brought up multiple times, and it will continue to be brought up because it's an issue that I think that rings true with the majority of Californians.
Yeah.
So, all right. You've been listening to Animal News, getting off to a rough start on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page. Over to you, Danny.
All right. Yeah, if there's any problems, we'll just blame it on the heat. That's the Chico way. A half century ago, long before premium wine and a high-tech boom transformed the Sonoma County Farmers' Day at the annual county fair, packed with several thousand spectators into the racetrack grandstand for a series of events, including something called the Pig Scramble, which involved freshly weaned piglets weighing 40 to 60 pounds. And as a whistle sounded, scores of kids ages 5 to 10 charged toward a pack of a dozen or so pigs. Back in those days, a half century ago, the winners got to keep the captured piglet And presumably they later ate it, I would assume. The annual,
the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. Letting kids, you know, farm to fork, so to speak. The annual scenario stayed mostly the same over the years, except at some point the kids didn't win the piglets. Instead, the piglets were retrieved by adult farmers, and the kids received gift certificates instead.
Matter what, though, it's the same end for the piglet.
Oh, yeah. And the 83-year-old Sonoma County Fair will, however, not include this event when it convenes in August. Instead, 20 elementary school kids will try to tote an oil-slicked watermelon around an obstacle course racing against the clock. I mean, that sounds a lot more fun and entertaining right off the bat, my visualization of this. The fair board members, acknowledging rising public concern and protests over animal welfare, eliminated the pig scramble from the lineup of agriculture-related contests on Farmers Day. Rob Mulrath, the fair board president, said the decision reflected a heightened awareness towards calls for humane treatment of farm animals. Mulrath, who is also a political consultant, grew up on a Santa Rosa area dairy ranch, exhibited livestock at the county fair for 10 years as a member of 4-H and Future Farmers of America, and competed in pig scrambles as a kid. Mulrath said he wasn't sure if the new watermelon obstacle course event would succeed in drawing more people to Farmers Day, which fair officials said had recently seen declining attendance. Animal rights activists hailed the replacement of scrambling for innocent animals with an inert fruit as a step towards acknowledging their cause. The executive director of the Sonoma County Farm Bureau, Tawny Tasconi, recalled her own participation in pig scrambles decades ago as a great activity. She viewed the termination of the event as an unfortunate decision, but one she supports as a former manager of the county fair. Those two opinions she holds do not align. We call that cognitive dissonance, I believe. The local ag industry was reminded of the cultural headwinds it now faces last month when busloads of animal welfare activists descended on a West Petaluma duck farm. I think we've talked about this duck farm in the past, right? Like, this was part of the foie gras ban, and then they got grandfathered in, and then I don't know if this is the foie gras one or not. I guess there's probably all duck farms might kind of co-locate for various reasons.
It depends on zoning. I do not think that the protest last month was at a foie gras facility.
I'm an American, so I'm not very good at geography either. Nearly 100 animal activists were arrested after some walked onto the property and others chained themselves together by the neck at the farm's main gate. Law enforcement responded to the disruption in large numbers, including a SWAT team and the sheriff's helicopter. Seems a bit excessive. Tasconi, the Sonoma County Farm Bureau executive director, told the Press Democrat that they, quote, "were all aware that we seem to be a target for them now," referring, of course, to possible future animal rights protests. That said, Sonoma County Fair Board President Mulrath said he was not aware of any involvement by animal rights advocates in the decision to discontinue the pig scramble. Annette O'Kelly, a longtime fair board member and chairwoman of the Agriculture Committee, acknowledged the pig scramble's long run, but said it was time for a change, saying that it's just the right thing to do. We don't want to see any of the animals get stressed out or hurt, making reference to the hot weather of August, which can be tough on pigs. Becky Bartling, the fair's chief executive officer, said the decision to drop the pig scramble stemmed from an effort to boost Farmers Day attendance. Asked if it had anything to do with allaying concerns that it was harmful to animals, Bartling said that she couldn't really speak on the matter.
Unbelievable.
It's a little... this is all good stuff, but they're trying really hard not to acknowledge what they're doing and why they're doing it. PETA lists pig scrambles among the events at state and county fairs it considers abusive to animals. Pigs are intelligent animals that perceive humans chasing them in a show ring as predators and are, quote, running for their lives, risking trauma and broken bones, said a PETA spokesperson, adding that with bullying now a topic of concern in schools, it seems particularly upsetting for these baby pigs to get harassed and tormented by children. I think I would agree with that. Though the pig scramble was canceled, it's not all good news for animals at the fair. Youth barrel racing on horseback with adult guidance was added to the program along with the watermelon obstacle race. Do you know what that is, Jeannie?
Barrel racing?
Well, are these children in a barrel on a horse?
No, no.
That seems awfully complicated.
They're riding horses and circling around barrels in a special kind of obstacle course involving horsemanship.
I've seen Lord of the Rings too much. I thought they were riding in barrels down the river. And finishing up here, the Farmer's Day lineup for this year's Country Fair still includes two other events PETA objects to: wild cow milking and, quote, mutton busting, in which little kids ride on sheep.
Right. So you feel exultant about this headline. They're dropping this pig scramble. And then at the very end, the story drops this bomb, right? These two entertainment activities that kids are involved in, or adults in the case of wild cow milking, are just as cruel as pig scramble. So it's just mind-boggling that this fair group could drop one exploitative animal entertainment and yet retain these other two. It completely obviates their decision to drop the pig scramble. So wild cow milking, I had to look it up, is a rodeo-type event that is a team-based competition where the goal is to catch and milk a so-called wild cow, that is a cow, a semi-feral cow that's not been, is not used to being milked by people, like a beef cow, a variety of cow. And the team is supposed to lasso, sometimes there's a cowboy involved on a horse, supposed to lasso and round up this this poor female cow to milk her.
So it's even more horrific than actually getting a dairy cow. It's getting a wild animal and terrifying it.
And milking it. You know, it's it would...
Which means it has a child somewhere that they took it away from.
Oh, yeah, that too. It's just my... And mutton busting, we've talked about this in the past. That's an event where... at rodeos, where little kids are strapped to... put on a sheep, and the sheep doesn't like it, and they get bucked off. Yeah. It's just I don't understand it. I guess it sounds like this fair group dropped this event without much prompting from animal rights advocates of their own goodwill. But it's mind-boggling that activity can be dropped, but these other two remain in good standing.
My supposition is that people complained about that event to them, and they don't want to admit that they took action based on complaints, because then they had to describe the complaints. But it seems like that's why. And if you can imagine 12 piglets squealing in terror, that's going to be upsetting to normal people watching, whereas the other events here, those animals don't make that same kind of noise. Unfortunately, fortunately for the piglets, their ability to squeal and raise ruckus might have saved them in this case.
All right. You've been listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio. I want to give our supporters, our underwriters, another shot here, since I know you folks probably didn't get to hear the first one.
Got to pay the bills.
I want to thank Ohm Foods, one of our underwriters, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. Ohm Foods serves homemade teas and lemonade, acai bowls, and smoothies blended with coconut water. You can find them at 142 Broadway, just 2 blocks from Chico State. And they're open Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., and on Saturday from 11 to 3, with to-go and catering available. For more info, you can find them at iloveohmfoods.com or on Facebook. All right, carry on, Danny. We have our third news story.
We have more news on the meatless meats that are finding their way to a fast food outlet near you from the website thetakeout.com. Most coverage of the rollout... Excuse me, I got a cough. Oh, dear. It's a bit warm here in the studio today, and we've got some fans running. Most coverage of the rollout of meatless fast food burgers like Burger King's Impossible Burger and White Castle's Impossible Slider pegs them as a long-awaited drive-through option for vegans. But new data indicates it's not vegans who are buying them, but meat eaters. And as someone who reads a comment or two on Facebook, I could have told them that. Most vegans want it to be not at the hamburger joint. A new report from market research firm NPD Group finds 95% of plant-based burgers, buyers have also purchased a beef burger within the past year.
Well done. Well done.
It's not the committed vegetarians or vegans who are buying meatless burgers, the report concludes, but so-called flexitarians, people who are trying to reduce their meat consumption but not rule it out entirely. This makes sense once you think about it. Established vegans may not need a food replicating the flavor and texture of a beef burger, but for avowed carnivores, a burger like Impossible or Beyond certainly makes plant-based eating much more palatable. I didn't do my mouth warm-up exercises today. The report notes that, quote, although vegetarians and vegans are certainly contributing to the growth in plant-based, they still represent a small, single-digits percentage of the U.S. population and aren't the primary contributors, end quote. Fast food chains no doubt needed to have carnivores buy in on these new products. Market research shows that meat eaters' appetite for meatless burgers helped push sales up 10% for the last 12 months versus a year prior. Beef burger growth, meanwhile, remains flat. The data indicate that's because carnivores are making a trade-off, at least sometimes. For every 18 fast food beef burgers they purchased over a 12-month period, customers bought two meatless ones.
So you're going to find the companies that sell, that make a profit off of burgers, they're not going to care how they make a profit.
Yep. And, I mean, we're notorious consumers as a nation, and we really like to consume things if people tell us it's less guilt, it's healthier for you, etc. So, you know, if you're at all adventurous as a meat eater showing up in these places and you see it, you might go, well, let me try it. You know, at least it has no cholesterol.
At least. Yeah, and if you want to find out more local options for that way of eating, check out the website ChicoVegan.com and the restaurant guide, and they have we try to keep it as current as we can for options. There's a lot of places in Chico that are serving the Beyond Burgers and the Impossible Burgers. All right. I want to give our other underwriter a fair shot here. That is Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. Thanks, Peterson Tree Care. All right, you're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM. We're up to our last news story. Our last news piece is from the peer-reviewed journal Nature about a potential revolution in the psychological research community about a useless and cruel form of animal experimentation, euphemistically called the forced swim test, which nearly every scientist who has used mice or rats to study depression is familiar with. This so-called swim test, I would also characterize it as a drowning test. Mice or rats are held by the tail and placed into a clear plexiglass cylinder of water with no place for them to grab onto, and so deep that not even their tail touches the bottom. Researchers videotape that scenario and watch to see how long the mice or rats try to stay afloat. In theory, as far as psychological research goes, a depressed rat will give up more quickly than a happy one, an assumption that has guided decades of research on antidepressants for you and me, and also helped the genetic modification industry for mice intended to induce depression in thousands of lab mice. Giving up in this scenario, in this cylinder of water, means that they stop actively paddling to find a way out and they just float, because fortunately or unfortunately for mice and rats, they don't drown, they float. So it's more a forced drowning test than a forced swim test. Like if you try to think of yourself as a human, if you were placed in this type of scenario, I don't think you would characterize it as a forced swim test. I imagine that if it were me, I'd feel like I was drowning, and I bet you would too.
And I can tell you that my level of wellness, whether I'm depressed or positive feeling, is not going to affect my desire to not drown in that moment.
Right, and how long that panic goes on,
yeah,
right?
I mean, there's... So. I'll comment more at the end of this.
All right. The article goes on to say that mental health researchers have become increasingly skeptical in recent years about whether that forced swim test is a good model for depression in humans. It is not clear whether mice stop swimming because they're despondent or because they have learned that a lab technician will scoop them out of the tank when they stop moving or when the six-minute test ends. Factors such as water temperature also seem to affect the results. Now, the animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, is jumping into the fray of this groundswell of revisionism in the animal experimentation community. PETA wants the U.S. National Institute of Mental Health, NIM, in Bethesda, Maryland, to stop supporting the use of forced swim tests and similar behavioral assessments by its employees and grant recipients because these tests, quote, create intense fear, anxiety, terror, and depression in these small animals without providing useful data. PETA wrote a letter to NIM with these recommendations on July of this year, and also noted that the NIM director, Joshua Gordon, had used the forced swim test in his own research in the early 2000s when he was a researcher at Columbia University in New York City. It's kind of like the fox guarding the hen house, right? Mm-hmm. Like a guy who's actually used these techniques isn't going to be entirely vested in eliminating them. However, in response, Gordon, this director of the of NIM, told the journal Nature that, quote, the National Institute of Mental Health has for some time been discouraging the use of certain behavioral assays, including the forced swim and another test called the tail suspension test, as models of depression. While no single animal test can capture the full complexity of a human disorder, these tests in particular are recognized by many scientists as lacking sufficient mechanistic specificity to be of general use in clarifying the neurobiological mechanisms underlying human depression. In other words, it's really not a good model at all.
That's bonkers.
Yeah. Hold your suspension here. The tail suspension test that's referred to in this small statement, that is another horrific test.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, mice are suspended by their tails with tape on a bar in another tube or in a box, such that it can't escape or hold on to or touch nearby surfaces. During this test, again, 6 minutes in duration, they score escape-oriented behaviors, and they call it a valuable tool in drug discovery for high-throughput screening of prospective antidepressant compounds. And one other wrinkle of this abhorrent test is that a mouse, and they only do it with mice, rats are too heavy, a mouse whose tail is taped to this horizontal bar can curl up and try to climb her own tail to get up onto the bar. So what they do is, to avoid that behavior because they can't score it, is they put a really stiff, clear plexiglass straw on the mouse's tail so that she can't curl the tail up and curl up on her own tail to get up to that bar. And yeah, it's just horrible. Anyway, to carry on, the director of NIM went on to say that these tests are still crucial for some specific scientific questions and that NIM will continue to fund such studies. Although scientists insist that behavioral tests that cause stress in animals are necessary for developing human treatments, the PETA campaign dovetails with scientists' own growing concern about the quality of data produced by forced swim tests, says Hanno Verbal, a behavioral biologist at the University of Bern, who says such tests are just bad science. Scientists developed the forced swim test in the 1970s. One of its earliest applications was studying the efficacy of drugs known as SSRIs, such as Prozac. In the forced drowning test, mice and rats who received SSRIs swam for longer periods than animals who did not. And thus, you have now a couple of decades of research along these lines because of these early tests that seem to be some kind of diagnostic. Due in part to concerns about the forced swim test accuracy, major drug companies such as Roche, Janssen, and AbbVie have actually abandoned the procedure in recent years. But many researchers still obligated to use the test, says Ron DeClote, a neuroendocrinologist at Leiden University Medical Center. That researcher told Nature, quote, people get their grants based on this test. They write papers based on this test, and they make careers of it. It's a culture which keeps itself alive, even though most of the researchers will admit that the tests themselves are not showing what they are supposed to do. And that is one honest researcher. NIM told Nature that it requires grant applicants to supply written justification for using animals in research and that its system review evaluates these descriptions very rigorously to determine whether the use of the animal proposed is appropriate and justified. So that is just the beginning of some rumblings of dissatisfaction and a change in culture. Because clearly the data coming from these tests isn't the crucial part. It's this culture of, like, yeah, you do what you've done before and you continue to do it.
Yeah, and after you've done this for 50 years, then it sounds like it makes sense. It sounds like you're using well-tested practices. And then you look at what they're doing, and I'm like, well, how do you not? I mean, I've taken antidepressants. They make you a little